Hello and welcome to the Denim and Boots podcast, episode
16.
16. Oh my gosh, we're on 16 now. It's been a while since we recorded one of these because Thomas has been on vacation. So anyways, I am one of your hosts, Jake, aka Almost Vintage Style.
And my name is Thomas, aka Denim Hunters.
And I'm Brian, aka The Right Stuff.
There we go. I was about to say we have a special guest. That is our...
@rightstuff.official. @rightstuff.official.
There we go. Nice. See? He's got the shameless plugging down already. That is good.
Absolutely.
Good. That's the good stuff. So, as you can see, we have a special guest, so this will be the main topic of our podcast today. We are very fortunate to have Brian from The Right Stuff here, and so he'll be talking about, you know, his story into denim and how he started a brand and what his brand does, and maybe sharing some of his knowledge on some more like shirts and old school clothing and stuff, because that's where he his kind of inspiration comes from, at least for his shirts, right? If I'm not speaking out of place.
Everything really is, it's mostly 1910s to 1930s is the majority of what I'm interested in, especially workwear, or pretty much just workwear.
But before we get to that, we have a bit of news. Jake, you mentioned that you have something to share.
So I have two things to share, actually. And so the first thing is that Connor's Sewing Factory is shutting down the S-Series production.
Oh.
At the very least, it's ending on the 31st of January.
Right.
So
which one is the S?
That's the one that he makes. So that's his super high-end... like the super accurate 1940s Levi's reproduction. So if anybody has been on the fence about ordering Connor's Sewing Factory, I think you better do it now. You have until July 31st. I talked to him personally. Obviously, we have a very good relationship. So he said that there is a chance that he will reopen production again. But that's not like... confirmed exactly what he's going to do. The Instagram post said something along the lines of like, it's, you know, it's almost getting too popular for its own good, as that's my interpretation, you know, with using Google Translate and everything. I didn't want to bother him too much, you know, but he's stopping production of the S, like ordering
on
July 31st.
What's the other series then that's not made by him?
So he has other sewers that he's trained and work in his workshop. So like, you know, I posted recently my jacket that I got embroidered, 49ers non. She did the embroidery. Yeah. I think she also sews some other later model jeans. So like the 50s series, like there's some 1950s series jeans. And he also just announced, I guess more news, he recently announced that they're starting production for a 1960s model.
Okay.
So Levi's reproduction.
The brand isn't shutting down at all. He's just not going to sew the products anymore, basically.
Well, that's not for sure either. Well, because he's got so many orders.
Oh, okay.
I don't know exactly. See, and this is going to make me sound real even more pretentious, and that's another piece of news, actually, is the Reddit thread. But I'm lucky to have a very good relationship with him. So if I order a pair of jeans, like, he'll give it to me as, like, ASAP. He'll drop everything and push me to the front.
Yeah.
And I think the actual wait time is much longer. It's several months, at least, I think, right now. Okay. And I think it's getting more, because he's actually like got a weirdly strong cult following, like very popular in Japan. Like he'll go somewhere and he'll get 50, almost 100 people to line up and like sell out everything he brings. Like he traveled recently. I forget exactly where he went, but he brought stuff and it was all sold out within like the beginning of the day.
Oh, okay.
So he does have like a real following. So I think it's something about it's getting very popular. So he wants, I don't know if he's going to reopen like just when he finishes and gets caught up with orders, but, or if it's like, it's just wants to take a break for a while too, on top of that with like his own production.
Right.
What I like is that he's not compromised and he's not going to have the S series made by somebody else or like expand. Like he did specifically say like he's the only one who's ever going to make the S series, like that's his thing, and I love that. That's one of the things I love about him. But so just saying, basically, for now, if you want a pair of Connors in the near future, and actually be guaranteed to get a pair, order it by July 31st. So I think, and this is just my, this is not like confirmed, this is my, he did say he thinks he might, I think he will, you know, eventually, probably within a year or so, reopen orders is my guess. It could be sooner than that. It could be later than that. It could be never. I don't know. But,
in any case, we'll listeners will have to, you know, stay tuned for that.
And, yeah, exactly.
Basically just follow him for updates, I guess.
That's the best so that's way. Interesting. Definitely interesting news.
And then you said something about Reddit. What's that about?
Okay, so this is the second piece of news. So we had a Reddit thread that went up.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody, you know, shared our podcast on Reddit, and the reception was obviously not, I mean, you can expect it's not very positive. It's Reddit. What do you expect?
Read it.
Don't worry, Thomas. Most of the criticism was on me, which I completely understand.
See,
why.
I'm just now, having been away for like 2 weeks, and I don't know if anyone saw this. I did a live Instagram video just before I left, and I turned off my phone, and I turned off my computer for 2 weeks. I had to turn on my phone, I think, 3 or 4 times for like 5 minutes to do a quick check. So I've been totally away. So this is all news to me too. Yeah.
It wasn't as bad as I thought it would be, honestly. But you know, it's
anyway. Well,
it's obviously negative. So I mean, I'm not surprised. Could have been a lot worse.
So what's the main criticism? What's the main?
Oh, main criticism is that I'm a pompous jerk and I dress like an idiot and I
hot meat kettle.
And I,
and what?
He said, "Pot meat kettle."
Mm-hmm.
And I talk over Thomas constantly and the guests.
It's not everyone on Reddit, you know.
Yeah, Reddit's great for like memes and stuff.
And they have a lot of knowledge about like leather and like Goodyear welting and stuff too, about shoes.
Okay.
I don't personally go on Reddit much myself. I rarely do,
but in the past year or so, for some reason, I found myself more on there just finding random answers to stuff.
Gotcha. Interesting.
Yeah.
So that's, anyway, that's I thought it was interesting. There were a couple of fair points where like I could, you know, not interrupt Thomas so much.
But that's old news, honestly, because we know this. I mean, it's
that's true.
We talk about it live when we record sometimes, even that, okay, this is how we do it and we're aware about it and, you know, it's just what it is. Obviously we can improve. We've been improving all along, basically. But I'm gonna go check it out.
Right. It's interesting that they said I also talked over the guests though, which I actually thought I didn't do that really.
I don't think so.
Not really.
Let's see if you're gonna talk over this guest. So speaking of guests, Brian, you also had a piece of news you wanted to share.
I just got in the sample for the restock of the Loopwheel Pocket Tee.
Mm-hmm.
We've changed up the sizing a little bit. So I used to wear small. I used to be the smallest size, and now I'm medium.
Okay. So it's gotten a little smaller in the size.
So whoever, if you couldn't buy small before because it was too big for you, you're in luck this time. Same thing with the Atlas shirt. So just switching over all the sizing to make sure we get people who are a little bit smaller than me. I'm like 179 cm. You know, 71 kilograms.
Okay.
You know, so in Merkin, that's like 5'11", 150 something pounds.
my gosh, so if you're smaller so much, than me.
Yeah, you're in luck. You're in luck. But with Loop Wheel, it's just a little different because, you know, those loops, they come in set sizes.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You can't.
Exactly.
Unless you want to cut it and turn it, add side seams or something. And then you can, like, I can't do like a double or triple XL or something. It just, they don't even make them.
No, then you have to cut it. And yeah, I know Ironhide does that for instance.
Yeah, I could cut it, but you know. Yeah.
Right. But that's
kind of, then it partly defeats the purpose of loop wheeling.
Well, yeah, I mean, you still get the quality, but yeah, obviously, you know, you don't get
the. Yeah, you get the fabric, but you will get the side seams. Yeah. So.
And I do actually have one more piece of news that I want to share though, and it's very related because I ordered a shirt from Brian.
Oh, oh.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, I almost forgot about
that. Is it there yet?
No, it's not, actually.
So.
Oh, God.
All right. And it won't be here tomorrow.
It's there soon.
It won't be there tomorrow either, because it's... For those who don't know, this is it's January 3rd, right? And actually, it'll become January 4th as I record this.
July.
July.
Sorry, July. My God, my goodness.
You already
school is taking a lot out of me. Yeah. It's it'll be Murica Day. It'll be Murica Day. So
in 20 minutes at this point for you, I guess.
Yeah, 19 minutes. It'll be Murica Day. So
nice.
So and people will be shooting off fireworks outside your house.
Yeah. Yes. So Brian suggested that if you hear fireworks, you need to drink something. You know.
Yeah, take a drink during this. Yeah. If you're listening, if you can, you know.
Except for those that listen.
If you're driving, though, maybe don't take an alcoholic drink.
If you're driving, drink coffee.
Yes.
Or drink water.
Yes.
If you're at work, take a bite out of a snack or something. Your celery. Mm-hmm. You know.
Whatever.
Yeah. Say one bad thing about your boss under your breath every time a firework goes off.
Yeah.
Well,
be careful with it.
I mean, so guys, you don't trust me with the editing because I'm pretty good at it. No one's going to hear fireworks, you know? So,
dude, I am not going to, like, you should not put that on yourself, Thomas. That is not a good idea to put that on yourself. But yeah, Brian and I have actually been talking for like 2 years, basically at this point, you know, with each other on Instagram, and I've always been into his stuff and I've always wanted to get something from him. But the issue always was like, he's produced stuff that are similar enough to things that I already have that like, I wouldn't quite go for it basically. The Atlas shirt that he produced in, the sage green chambray, which is really, really cool. I weightlifted myself out of the freewheelers one that I have in a basically the same or similar color. So I needed to get a new one because that's like probably one of my top five favorite shirts. So fortunately, his is like the only one that you can even get in that color right now, I'm pretty sure. Because freewheelers used to make them, but not. Yeah. So I'm very excited to get that.
Nice. Yeah, just looking at it now. That's a nice one. But Brian, obviously we're going to talk about how you make your things how you even got started in the first place. But before we do that, let's talk a bit about, who you are and how you got to where you are now. Also, you know, privately, because obviously listeners can tell now by now, I guess, that you're an American. But you don't live in America, so let's go back a little bit, because Jake also thought you were English, I think. So,
well, I was born in Scotland, but it's just my dad happened to be living there. I mean, my parents were there because he moved around a lot for work.
Mm-hmm.
He was a logistics manager for overseas shipping companies. So it's like he moved to Mexico and Scotland and Egypt and Singapore and Venezuela and all these different places because, you know, they'll do like a 2 or 3 year project. And then it's like, okay, we're putting you on the next project. You know, it's in England. What do you think about that?
Okay.
You know? Yeah. So.
So you were.
They happen to be in Scotland.
Yeah. You were born in Scotland, but then you were raised in, you mentioned Florida and Texas.
After Scotland, we moved to Egypt for like 6 months or so, a year, and Singapore, and then we moved to Annapolis, Maryland, and then to Florida. Florida was like 6 years or something. We moved there in like 1988, something like that.
And you were born in
1984.
All right.
Yeah, so we moved there in like 88, 89. And, you know, stayed there. And then I moved to Houston 4 years, and then Venezuela 4.5 years. And then I moved back to the U.S.
Hmm. Okay. So you had high school, your high school age was in Texas, then in Houston?
Venezuela. And then final year was in Texas, in Houston.
Right, so that's why you speak Spanish fluently, obviously, then.
Yeah, well, my mom is from Mexico, actually.
Oh, okay, so that too. Okay.
Yeah, so I grew up speaking Spanish and English, and then, I practice it in Venezuela to more, high school level classes, yeah.
Of course. Right.
So you were in Venezuela before current.
Before Chavez, and then during... While he was elected, I moved there in like 97 and I left in August 2001 or something like that, July 2001.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But now, but you don't live in the US now?
No.
No.
I stayed in Texas from 2001 till like 2012. And then at that time, like a bunch of stuff happened all at the same time. It was like my dad, he kept going to Australia for work for like 3 or 4 weeks at a time and would come back for like a week or two and then would like leave for 3 weeks. And then it's like at that time I was working as a journalist. I mean, that's what I majored in school, and I was a journalist. And I got laid off from my job, and they slowly laid off all the writers. And then finally me, I was one of the editors, and I was looking for new jobs, and just like nothing good was, happening at that time, 2012 in the US, the economy was not really popping off, and journalism was just, don't get into it if you want to make money or anything, don't quit your day job.
No.
And especially at that time, I was just nothing good was cropping up. It's like, we can offer you 30 hours a week, so we don't have to pay you health insurance or anything like that and stuff like that. And I was like, man, I got to get out of this career, And stuff, it's like at that time, my mom died. And so my dad moved to Australia, and my brother, he moved off for school, acting school. And I was just sort of like, I'm looking for jobs in Texas and nothing's good was happening, nothing good was cropping up. And I met a bunch of people from Taiwan. They're like, maybe you can just apply for jobs there or something, who knows? So I did. And I got like a bunch of responses right away. And I was like, well, time to do something crazy, It's like, I'd always wanted to live in Hong Kong. And then, but I had met some people from there, and I saw like it was pretty expensive to live in Hong Kong and, that kind of stuff. And so I thought, well, Taiwan's pretty close, right? So so I moved out here, and I've just been here ever since.
Right. What, why Hong Kong? What drew you there?
I'd always since I was a kid, I'd always really been into Bruce Lee movies. And then in college, my roommates asked me if I wanted to join like the Tai Chi club one day. And so I was like, yeah, all right. And then, I'd done karate as a little kid for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, yeah, okay. And then we found a teacher in Dallas. I was going to school in Dallas, a Kung Fu teacher from China who's like really, really, really good. So we started going to school and we started learning kickboxing and then, like traditional kind of Kung Fu stuff and Tai Chi, and did that for 5 or 6 years or something. And in college, actually originally what I was studying was film. So I was a real big movie nerd, just always all day, every day watching movies. And so I was really big into Hong Kong films, among others.
Okay.
I really liked the idea of Hong Kong and I really wanted to move there. I thought it looked really cool, in all these 70s and early 80s Hong Kong movies.
So you moved out to Taiwan in 2012 then?
Yeah, like late 2012.
So what was it like?
When I was on the plane, I was sitting there and I was like, what the hell did I just do, Like, what have I gotten myself into?
Yeah.
And the next time I would have that feeling was when I would meet John Lofgren. I was like, oh, God, what have I done? I came out and, it was very complicated at first, trying to get all set up and everything. But I really loved it. It was like It's just like a whole new world. A whole new world. And sorry, I haven't seen the new Aladdin yet.
From the original Aladdin, not the new Aladdin.
From the 1992. Oh. Or I don't know. I saw it in theaters. I almost threw up during the carpet ride scene because I was in the front row.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it was front row seating. And I was like, I got dizzy watching it. But I really liked it out here. And then I got a job. Well, I got a job at first, and then the guy apparently didn't do his homework and didn't have the capital to hire a foreigner. So he fired me after 2 hours of working on the job. Oh, he gave me like $300 cash. He's like, here, I'm sorry. but yeah, I mean, I started working at a magazine. And then from there, that was oddly enough how I got introduced to the whole raw denim world.
Yeah, right. But what about language? I mean,
I didn't speak any Chinese before I moved out here. I mean, I downloaded an app, and I...
That was fireworks. Hold on.
Yep.
Hold on. Chug. chug, pleb. Yeah, I started learning Chinese once I signed up at a school and started learning Mandarin Chinese, which is what they speak in Taiwan.
I mean, because Hong Kong, obviously, they speak pretty good English, I guess, everyone.
But
Taiwan is different. Yeah.
Taiwan, I mean, younger people, everyone here takes English, you know, starting from elementary school. And some of them, their parents send them off to like preschool, you know, all English. So,
okay.
So most people speak English here, but yeah, at first it was very complex. Like you go to the bank or like the hospital or something like that. And all of a sudden nobody knows any English, you know, and it's like, oh boy.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can kind of manage sort of, you know, you can sort of manage, and everybody studies it. And then I started learning Chinese. And so it's kind of worked out that way.
Yeah. All right. So you ended up, so you got fired from that job after 2 hours, and then you found a new one.
Yeah, I got a new one working in a magazine. And after about a year or so there, my introduction to the raw denim world is really embarrassing. They asked me to write an article about menswear dog. I don't know if you guys remember this.
Menswear dog?
It's a guy. He had a blog back then. I think he still does. It's like a guy and his wife in New York City, and they would dress up their Sheba in like his outfits and take photos of it.
Wow.
And so the Sheba would be wearing like a chambray shirt and like a Stetson hat or something, you know, and
Jesus.
And every day is like a different outfit. And they told me to write an article, like, you know, just kind of a little feature soft article about this. I was like, okay. And then I went, you know, like on his blog and everything, and I saw some of the clothes the dog was wearing. It's like, hey, that's kind of a nice shirt. And then he had a scarf on that I really liked, and it turned out to be from the hillside in New York, Hickories.
Yeah,
that's
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. So I went on their site and I was like, wow, some of this stuff is really freaking cool, you know? And as part of the guy's bio, his tagline, it said something like, and never washing my selvedge denim. And I was like, what the hell is selvedge denim?
Oh.
So I looked that up.
Why the hell don't you wash it? You know, but that's another story. Sorry.
Yeah. Why don't you wash it? You know, nudie.
Yeah.
But it was like, yeah, this is really cool. Where do I buy this? In Taipei, in Taiwan. And it said, go to Take 5 jean store. Mm-hmm. So I went there and I bought a pair of Fellows 441 jeans, I think.
Right.
And then I bought some Red Wing 875 mock toe boots, and then that was it. I just went down the rabbit hole.
And that was then 2013 or still 12?
Like around 2013 or something, like, you know, like around Christmas or something, 2013, I think.
Okay.
I want to say.
So up until this point, you didn't, I mean, were you interested in clothing before, or was this sort of...
I mean, I'd been interested in clothing since I was about 12, because back when I was 12, I became like a serious metalhead.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know, I went over to my friend's house and he played Metallica's Injustice for All. And I was like, oh my God, what is this? You know? And so in a sense, like if you're a metalhead or, you know, and back then, I mean, okay, it's like 1995, but you know, back then, like you had your cliques in school and the way you identified yourself was your clothes. You know, it's like, okay, the metalheads wear this, the punks wear that, you know, the jocks wear this, the rappers wear that kind of thing. So obviously as a metalhead, it's like, okay, you got to get this shirt and these pants and this wallet with the chain and all this stuff. And then in college, I decided I wanted to dress in more for like a classic style. And I didn't really know how to do that. But, you know, so I would just go to, I don't know, the Gap or whatever I could find, you know, and just, you know, department stores. I'd end up in, I don't know, Dillard's or something. And then I found a vintage shop in town, which didn't really have anything good, but I would just buy random stuff from there. I got like a black leather, you know, Perfecto style jacket and, you know, my Slayer shirt or whatever at first. And then later I decided, you know, on some classic stuff. But no, I didn't know about like all of this world until the tail end of college. I started seeing, you know, there was more of an emphasis, I guess. I mean, this was like 2007, 2008 in the US. There seemed to be more of this like mainstream emphasis on guys dressing well, you know?
Okay.
It started to sort of creep out from, you know, I didn't know where at the time. But this idea of like hashtag menswear and everything started to, you know, enter the mainstream consciousness, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, there really was the raw denim world, you know. That was when I first got introduced to this sort of thing.
So that's around 5-6 years ago now at this point.
Yeah, so it's pretty recent. I mean, I didn't, you know, I didn't grow up in like Levi's 501s and wear them to the beach and like, you know, ocean wash them as a kid. And like, you know, I don't have some great like origin story of like I was picking in barns or something and finding vintage stuff, you know, unfortunately.
No, I mean, yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
But you got into it sadly. Then. And so what happened then?
Then I was just a fan for a little while, for a year or so. And then I had a coworker sometime in like 14, I think, late 2014, he was leaving. He was going to move back to the US. Mm-hmm. And we were just talking and he's like, so, you know, are you going to open up your own like leather and denim and silver store? And I hadn't really thought about that. And then I was like, yeah, that sounds like a really good idea, you know? So I thought about that for a while and I started saving up money on the side, sort of planning on how to do that. And I was like, well, the good thing about Taipei is it's not that expensive, that hard to just sort of rent a storefront and open a store, you know, like compared to the US or somewhere where there's a lot more costs associated with that. I mean, you can have some of those successful stores here are really actually pretty small square footage wise. Like they're really small, you know, but that's okay. And so I planned about, you know, how to go about doing that for a while. And then eventually what happened was I changed courses. Kyle or Colt Summer posted on Superfuture. We were talking because I'd been a fan and I'd been buying stuff, you know, mostly from Japanese brands because they don't really sell most of the American brands out here, you know. So I can't like go down to a store and at that time pick up like Rogue Territory or 316 or something. Like no one really sells it. But they do sell like the Flathead and Samurai, and they were selling Fellows and Warehouse and Sugarcane and stuff like that. Toys McCoy, those kinds of brands are really easy to get a hold of. And I could find pants that fit me. I could find boots, you know, belts, jacket, but I always struggled with shirts. I could never get a shirt from a Japanese brand that fit me well. And it's like, I have all these shirts and my best fitting like workwear style shirt was some cheap one that I picked up at the Gap that was like a faux Wabash calico print with like these Big Yank style diamond buttons. I mean, whoever designed it, obviously, you know, knew about vintage stuff, but, you know, they work for the Gap. And that was my best fitting shirt. I mean, it fitted me perfectly everywhere. The neck, you know, the shoulders, the sleeve length, the body length, the chest. It was just, and I was thinking, I was like, if only I could get this fit, but with like better fabric and like made in Japan or US or whatever. And I kept waiting and it's like, you know, no one's going to make it, I think, unless I just do it myself. You know, sometimes if you want something done right in life, you just need to do it yourself. And we were talking about that, I think, on Super Future. And Kyle Cold Summer, he mentioned, he's like, it would be pretty cool if someone were to start like a made-to-order company or brand like this, where you would use those materials and then people would put in orders with their measurements for like workwear, like Western style shirts. Mm-hmm. And he basically said, you know, he has no intention of pursuing this idea, but someone else can take the idea and run with it. And I thought about that for a long time and I was like, yeah, that could be doable, you know. But I had to consider, I was like, okay, do I want to be a one-man brand or not? And that was like a big consideration. And I was thinking, I was like, okay, if I want to do that, I need to move into a bigger place. I need to get a lot of sewing machines. I need to learn how to sew much better than I can.
Did you know how to sew already? Did you have any?
Just by hand, I can do some, but I'd never touched a machine, okay. You know, and yeah, it was yeah. like, okay, I need to figure all that out. And then it's like, how many years is it going to be? You know, it's like, I'm going to have to be self-taught because I don't have anyone here who can teach me like how to make workwear shirts, you know? Mm-hmm. How many years is it going to be before I'm good enough to actually sell this to a person, you know, and have them wear it? And if I do that and I do make it, how much is that going to take out of me? Like, because it's like, I like one man brands and I really love, you know, that it's so direct and it's just you and the maker and then they make what you want or they make what they want. And then you know, like Roy or something before, but, and then it's like all the guys who are really successful at that, guys and girls, it's like one day, eventually you're just going to be chained to a table somewhere, you know? Mm-hmm.
Speaking of,
because it's like you're only one person, you know, you only have
yeah.
two arms and two legs and it's like you only have 24 hours in the day yeah. and it's like I still have a day job too, and it's like, all right, and it's like I think that would be okay if it were acceptable for you to bring people on, but I think it's kind of hard to do that, you know. It's like people want you to make it, they don't want your, you know, your understudy or something. It can be done, you know. I mean, like, I don't know, Aero Leathers or someone, they have multiple people working there. But people, I guess, put in requests, like, I want specifically this person to make it for me.
Yeah, that's a common thing with Aero.
Yeah, I've seen it on Fedora. It's like, okay, so-and-so has to make it for me. And it's like...
But it's also very okay, much, so you know, that, speaking of Connors in the beginning of this episode, you know, that... You know, yeah. being chained to the table, you said, basically. So
yeah, I
so
mean, Roy also, it looks like, did Roy go out of business officially or what? I don't know. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, he's saying he's basically going to try to sell his stuff off by the end of the year. So okay.
yeah, that much he did say on Instagram, like, this business is for sale or something. And and so there's a certain nobility to that. It's like, at the end of the day, you know, if you're going to go out, you're going to go out on your shield
yeah.
and you're going to do it your way. And all, but it is kind of hard. It's like, well, my goal was really, it's like, I want to see how big this can get or not. I want to beat the biggest brands in this business at their own game. You know, that was my challenge to myself. And it's like, well, I can't do that as a one man brand. All respect to them and everything, but it's like, I don't want to offer just one product either. You know, or one or two or three. I want to do like everything. It has to be like a whole sort of, you know, ecosystem or something.
So, you know, just to put this, I mean, into a time frame, when did you start thinking about this? Was this 2014, you said, when your friend left?
This was like 2014, 2000, 2015, probably seriously thinking about it.
And at the time, you were still working at that magazine, or you, so you were working as a journalist full-time, you know, living, you know, a day, you know, having a day job, really. And
Well, I technically still do have a day job. I mean, the right stuff doesn't quite, you know, pay the bills yet. Sorry.
No.
So I need, I was telling Jake, I need like 20 or 30 or 40,000 Instagram followers. And then I can, then I'll quit my day job and then it will pay the bills, because I'll spend so much time going to the post office that I don't think I, you know, would be able to go to a job. Because currently, I mean, the way it works is it's not super time consuming in the sense that I like have to sit in an office, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day and like work on this. It's more like, you know, it's like I need inspiration, and then I need to come up with a design and choose the right fabrics and think about when to release it and what to call it and all of that kind of stuff. It's not actually time consuming, but it is hard to, you know, decide on.
Yeah. So you decided then not to, you know, try and learn to sew your things yourself, and you went down another route. So tell us about that, because I think that's really, really interesting how you got there.
Yeah, I thought, okay, well, I could work with a small sewing factory and they could help me make my designs for me. And then, you know, I just handle everything else. And because there is, you know, there's a lot of stuff to it, you know, taking photos and posting on Instagram and chatting with people on Instagram and, you know, setting up your website and replying to emails and sending stuff and all that actually is time consuming. I like it, but you know, it takes up some of my time.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, okay, well, let me reach out. I'm in Taiwan. I could make it in Taiwan, but there are some problems with that, you know, in terms of how business is done here and the perception of made in Taiwan as being basically the same as made in China, which it's not, but you know, it also depends on the factory you're working with here. Is that fireworks?
I don't know.
No, just a loud car.
Oh, okay. All right. I was going to drink, but,
we did have some fireworks actually 8 minutes ago, but I didn't want to interrupt you. That was around.
And there was also another one that we missed because I muted my mic because I need to take a drink. So,
okay.
Okay.
Water. So,
all right. Yeah. So, I was like, okay, well, but I'm pretty close to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Japan, for me to fly to Tokyo is a 3.5 hour flight and it costs like $300 round trip.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So it's like Japan is pretty close, you know? I mean, Taiwan used to be a colony of Japan, so it was, you know, it's really close. I mean, if you go to the East Coast on a clear day, you can see one of the islands of Okinawa. So it's not that far away. And so I thought, okay, making in Japan. Okay, let's try this out. So I spent, you know, all day trying to find factories and sewing factories and fabric mills in Japan. And the mills actually did get back. Some of them did get back to me. You know, they sent me samples of fabric and I could do that. But I never heard back from a single factory. And I started to kind of wonder about that. And eventually I did find one factory and I called them up on the phone and they basically just, you know, it was like, it's like, no, this isn't, you know, you can't just call us up on the phone like that. And this is my first sort of taste. I didn't understand, you know, this is sort of how it's done in Japan
mm-hmm.
for the most part with factories. It's like you don't just like walk in off the street, you know. And later John Lofgren would explain this to me because he ran into the same thing when he was first starting his brand. It's like the factory's right down the street. Like, why don't we just walk in? You know, he's arguing with his wife. Why don't we just walk in and introduce? It's like, no, you can't. You can't just introduce yourself, you know, like just some guy off the street. You need to be introduced by a mutual third party. And, you know, it's sort of like a trust-based. I mean, it's almost like a feudal era sort of system. Like Edo era sort of system.
Yeah.
So but I had no idea.
But how do you get to know John then? Was that?
Okay, well, at that same time, I gave up on making in Japan. So I contacted factories, sewing factories in the US, and they were all responding like right away.
Mm.
Within a day or two, one of them responded within like 30 minutes, you know, email.
Wow.
And they all said, all right, we can do it. You know, I think I got some selvedge chambray fabric lying around. I had decided, okay, I'm going to make one product. It's going to be a chambray shirt. It's going to be, you know, this scalloped yoke, vent hole, Reliance Manufacturing or Big Yank Design, because that was sort of like my desert island shirt. If I could only take one shirt on a desert island, that would be it. So they said, yeah, we can do it. Just need to see the design so we can quote you on how expensive it's going to be or not and all this stuff. And I was thinking, yeah, but, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to have stuff made in USA and then sent back to me to Taiwan. And then, you know, what if my customer's in the US and, you know, I don't like it.
Mm.
So I had seen online before that John Lofgren had made some stuff for some people. You know, he had done like one pair of pants for Bandana Almanac years ago, like 2012 or something like that. And he had done some stuff for some little brand called Heritage Research, which I guess they became TSPTR. They changed their name and changed their... I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, I have sneakers that are like John Lofgren, Standard & Strange, TSPTR sneakers.
Yeah. So he has done these collaborations here and there before. And I had noticed that he didn't really make his own branded clothes anymore. You know, he was only really doing... boots and sneakers and stuff. So I sent John a message on Instagram, and don't everybody go out there and start spamming his inbox, sliding into those DMs on Instagram. But I sent him a message, and it's like he didn't reply for like a week or something, a week and a half, 7-9 days, something like that. And I kind of, you know, after like day 3 or 4, I kind of gave up on that too. And finally he replied, and he was like, yeah, we can do it, you know.
Hmm.
We can help you, you know, we can help you make stuff. I guess he said he looked at my profile and he's like, okay, you know, this guy works for Heddles.com. He probably knows more than the average person or something. You know, it's like...
So there's new information as well. So first of all, when was this then? Are we talking now 2016 or are we still in 15?
Yeah, this would have been like December 2015.
Okay.
January 2016.
And at that point, you were already writing for Heddles.
Yeah, I sometime in 2014, I just sent an email out to Heddles. I was like, hey, you guys need writers? And they came back and said, yeah, we need fades writers. So basically, you write the fade of the day. Before that, they were called rawdenim.com, and they only had a fade Friday.
I know, yeah.
But they had decided they wanted a fade every single day of the week.
Yeah.
Fade or patina. Can be leather boots, can be a jacket, can be a belt, can be any sort of well-worn item.
Yeah.
Can be your cast iron skillet, you know. But shameless plug. But, you know, submit, go on Heddles.com, submit your well-worn stuff. But, yeah, it was around that time I had become, they had bumped me up to Fade's editor. So I'm one of the editors there still, actually, to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw that, and I guess he figured that I'm somewhat established and, you know, kind of have a reputation, something to put on the line regarding this. So he said, yeah, are you going to be at Inspiration LA? And I said, not really. He said, okay, well, I'm going to be in Sendai, Japan, which is where his office and his store, Speedway, and he has a store next door, the Nigel Cabron store. I'm going to be in Sendai in February. It's not necessary, absolutely necessary to always, you know, to plan this face-to-face, but it's usually better. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll be there. So I flew out and I met John in February 2016, I want to say.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, I remember seeing him. I met him at a hotel at first, and he came around the hallway, and I was like, holy shit, that's John Lofgren, you know? like, this is someone I've only ever seen, like, in the magazines, you know, or on Instagram or whatever. This is, like, a semi-famous person.
Yeah.
You know? And he's, like, walking up to me. I was like, oh, my God, what have I done, dude? Like, holy shit, I'm in deep trouble now, you know? Like, you know, what if I fail? You know, what if I let everyone down? I was like, oh, God damn. Okay, so... But we met and it went well.
Yeah, it did, because not that long after, I guess, you launched your brand.
Yeah, I mean, basically we went to his office and we met, you know, all day, and, you know, went to his store, went to his office and met all day, and, you know, I think we had lunch and dinner together. I mean, it was like, and met the next day too. But you know, went over fabrics, went over the design. I had some buttons. I had some dead stock buttons ready to go. But otherwise, it was like, you know, you have to decide on the tag. Do you want printed or woven? And what kind of hang tag and swing tag should you have? And, you know, which colors you're going to choose and all this stuff, which sizing, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And, just waited for the sample to be made, and that usually takes about 2 to 3 months for a sample to be made, and got the samples and then waited for actual production products to arrive, which usually takes another 2 to 3 months. And by that time it was about like June 2016, and then I launched with the Heracles shirt.
Yeah, that was until you launched with that first product. Only one product.
Right? Yeah, I figured I wanted, I mean, it's just going to be one product, and it needs to make some sort of statement. You know, like I could have made a more subdued shirt, or I could have made like a t-shirt or something like that, you know, but I wanted something that, you know, because first impressions count. So I wanted something that made a bit of a statement and, you know, is a little complex. I mean, it's pretty complex in its design, and one of the things I messed up was that I priced it too low because it's such a complex design. And both me and John, we both like to price things, you know, as fairly as possible. Because, you know, other brands that are selling a somewhat similar shirt, you know, they go for like $220, something like that.
And how much is yours?
And,
it
was $160.
Okay. Yeah.
Which, you know, kind of shot myself in the foot a little bit. It needs to be a little bit more, and I'm going to remake it, and I'm sorry, everybody. You know, I'm unfortunately going to have to raise the price a little bit because it is a complex pattern. All those curves with the triple stitching, it's very easy for the seamstresses to, you know, it's a very easy thing to make mistakes on. And it's a selvage fabric, but you know, the fabric for the Atlas shirt is more expensive, actually. It's thicker. But the pattern is kind of complex. So, sorry, everyone, when it comes to Atlas or Heracles 2.0, unfortunately. I don't want to be that brand that's always, you know, randomly jacking up prices. But actually, you know, and you might ask at some point, but it's like the hardest part about doing all of this stuff for me is getting the retail price correct, you know? That's probably the hardest part about running a brand for me, because it's just, it's like $10 too much or too, you know, or too low. And you like, it could throw everything out of alignment.
But at this point, can you only buy it from your website, or do you have retailers as well?
No,
because with this pricing,
stockers.
You do have stockers, yeah.
Yeah, I have some retailers. I have some. It's stockists. It's always, you know, it's kind of like sometimes they put in an order, sometimes they don't. So, you know, it's not like they're not going to have all of the products or anything. But I've had orders from, you know, all kinds of stockists. And currently I'm thinking of who has my stock. I mean, in Taiwan, there's a store called Mr. Old. They have stock. Redcast Heritage in Spain, They have stock. office hours in San Luis Obispo, California. They have stock. Yesterday, I just picked up a new stockist in St. Louis, Missouri, called Crimson Serpents Outpost.
Oh.
So, you know, Missouri is not, it's not like a place where they have a lot of stores for this kind of thing. So the Midwest, and, you know, in general, actually. And who else has put in orders recently? Those have been the most recently. You know, I've had other stores have put in orders before, and then, you know. And then also, John's store, Speedway, now has the Atlas shirt in stock.
Okay.
In Japan.
Oh, that's cool. I actually didn't know about that.
Yeah, they haven't gotten it up. They have so many products that they come in, and they tend to space them out when it comes to, like, posting it online. So they have like all these Freewheelers shirts and Filson stuff and Nigel Caborn, and you know, they've got like a huge backlog of like products that are always coming in. So I'm a new brand too, so I think that they're, you know, trying to educate the customers and all that too as well.
So what about the shirts themselves? Like where did you get, you know, inspiration from, and the design and the fabrics and everything? Like, I want to kind of dive into that, because, you know, from the what you sell, if people don't know, if they haven't, you know, already gone to your website or your Instagram, right? They're chambray shirts and loop wheel t-shirts and you know, the Henley and all that, so they're definitely staples of this type of clothing. So I think it'd be interesting to like learn about that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously at first it started with, okay, what kind of shirts do I have and what do I have experience with? What do I like? What do I not like? But really it's, I'm a vintage and a catalog junkie, you know, and I don't buy as much vintage as I'd like, cause it's just so damn expensive to, that's, that's an expensive hobby. And I don't live in the U.S., so I can't, like, go out and, you know, thrifting and picking all the time. Because if I did live out there, that's probably what I would do, like, every weekend, you know. But I buy small some pieces here and there. And then John actually has a fairly sizable vintage collection that we can refer back to. And because the factories are so used to making this kind of stuff, I can just... In a lot of cases, I can just draw it and then they'll know how to do it. But, which is, that saves a lot of time and effort. But, also just catalog. I mean, I'm online, I'm researching all the time catalogs from department stores, you know, Montgomery Ward, Sears Roebuck, Charles Williams, MW Savage, specifically 1910s to about 1939. 1940, for the most part, is kind of like my cutoff date, and I don't really pay attention to much after that. I guess for a couple of reasons, not in a snobbish way, but just, you know, in the last 10, 15, 20 years, there have been a lot of brands that have done 40s and 50s stuff, and really well, you know, and it seems like every other brand does 40s and 50s stuff, and that's cool. You know, I have some 40s. And 40s inspired, and 40s, 50s vintage and inspired type stuff that I wear and I like. But what's more interesting to me really is like 10s, 20s, 30s, because the more I look at vintage stuff, it's clear to me that that was the high point. That was the high watermark. That was the golden age. And, you know, 40s and 50s, there were some new designs that were introduced in that time that were really good, but for the most part it was kind of like maintaining what had already been created, especially in the 20s and 30s. It was kind of like just a continuation of what had already come along, and maybe a streamlining in some cases, you know. Levi's, okay, we'll get rid of the buckle back, and they'd already gotten rid of the donut button, you know, suspender buttons and crotch rivet and stuff. But, you know, going back and looking at all the catalogs and all the photos, it's clear to me that, you know, the eras that ended up interesting me the most were 10s, 20s, 30s.
So, I guess, because, I mean, your two chambray shirts that you've released so far, I mean, they're both chambray shirts, but they're quite different in design too.
Yeah, well, the Heracles design, the original scalloped yoke design for that, the earliest example I've ever been able to find, I'd have to go back and look at my blog, but it was 1912, Sears Roebuck released a scalloped yoke back and yoke shoulder pullover chambray shirt, and that's the earliest example I can find of that design anywhere. And in the next year, or 1914, John Champion filed a trademark for it, and then Reliance Manufacturing Company of Chicago started making it and selling it as the Milton F. Goodman shirt. Milton F. Goodman was the founder of Reliance Manufacturing Company, which later ended up making Big Yank, which a lot of, you know, vintage people will know Big Yank. They were in the Midwest, I guess they were one of the big, or maybe the biggest workwear makers, one of the biggest, especially for shirts. They were really well known for their shirts. You know, I have on my wall, I have all these advertisements from them from the 1920s. I have one from the 30s framed up here, and Milton F. Goodman. Yeah, that was the first, you know, along with Sears Roebuck, that was the first commercially available example of that sort of scalloped yoke ventilation hole design. Of course, back then it was a pullover, because in the 1910s and 1920s, almost every work shirt was a pullover.
Yeah, you even showed...
At some point in the... go ahead.
Sorry, you even showed like pictures on your Instagram, yeah. Right, of that?
Yeah, on my Instagram. And if you go to my website, I posted my blog occasionally, and I did a two-part series on work shirts from 1910 all the way up to about 1939. And I have photos and examples of all of my research and everything that I've been able to get on this and dated chronologically. That's just sort of where all of this comes from, you know. So the Atlas shirt then is based on the standard Big Yank chambray work shirt that started coming out in the 20s. The Captain Khaki and just the standard Big Yank chambray. It has this style of pocket, and it's, double needle stitching and the high thin back yoke and, you know, chin strap, obviously. It has a different, the sleeve, the cuffs, that's actually a 1930s Big Yank thing with the sort of like single piece, you know, fold over cuff. That was from the 30s. That's a little later era. So I kind of, you know, forgive me, but I've you know, mixed two different eras together. So I'm not like an absolute 100% reproduction purist. I mean, if there's some detail that I see that, you know, I want to change, then I'll just try to make sure it's in the spirit of that times, I guess. But, you know, like with the pocket, Lupu pocket t-shirt, I mean, I've never seen an example of a t-shirt with a flap like that, but it's based on the Big Yank sort of design of work shirt pockets, like the Black Beauty pullover. It has that sort of like a chevron on the top. It's actually an open, it's not a flat pocket, but I decided to, you know, why don't we turn that into a flat pocket, see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm a catalog junkie. I spend too much money buying catalogs online and I need to stop myself, and I would have even more, but thankfully, websites like, you know, archive.org have a bunch of scanned free ones from libraries, and I go on there and take snapshots and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So what's you said in the beginning that you're getting a second production run of the Loopbill t-shirt, so that's coming up, but what else is on the horizon for you for Right Stuff?
Well, I've just drawn up the Heracles 2.0. Mm-hmm. I got the drawing sitting in front. It's not wildly different, but I will change the sizing to reflect the Atlas sizing. shorten the sleeves a bit, shorten the body a bit, which is what we did with the Atlas, and add the chin strap, add the selvage on the inside of the button placket, add the garment worker's tag inside, add a chain stitch runoff, which if you don't like it, you can cut it off. That's okay. Mm. You know, my feelings won't be hurt. But I do that sometimes. I've done it before. It won't affect the integrity of the shirt. But and then also make it in an ecru or off-white variant.
Yeah, that's very cool. I like too the changes with the sizing that you mentioned, because yeah. I think I looked at it many times and I was just thinking I think it's going to be a little too long for me. So
yeah, the original Heracles, the sizing is sort of closer to, you know, like a freewheeler's sort of thing, where like it's a bit long in the arms, you know, the sleeves are kind of long and thin, and I decided to just kind of rein it back in and make it more of a standard thing mm-hmm. with the Atlas.
Okay.
So, I mean, I would love to, like, you go back and look at catalogs from the 20s and 30s, and they would release, like, a standard chambray in three different sizing. You know, regular, tall, and stout.
Mm.
And that would be, I would love to do something like that and, like, hit every segment. You know, hit your endo, ecto, and mesomorph body types. But, you know,
yeah,
that's beyond my capabilities right now. But
so you're going to keep working with John then?
Yeah, the plan is to just keep making everything with John Lofgren basically in Japan. They can help out with making all kinds of stuff. I mean, obviously shirts. He used to make shirts and pants and jackets and all kinds of stuff under his own brand, and then he decided he would just focus on footwear.
Mm.
You know, sneakers and boots, and then really for his own brand, I guess mostly boots now. So he kind of stopped making clothes.
Right.
And so he helps, you know, a couple other brands make clothes, like, you know, Eastman and TSPTR and Papa Nui hats. So, you know, I kind of just have taken over a little bit there where he left off.
Mm-hmm.
And so he can help with almost any kind of, you know, workwear style clothes,
yeah,
making it. And if I ever want to do, you know, footwear or something, that would be fine too.
Yeah. I mean, his boots look pretty amazing, don't they? So.
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of great boots out there, but yeah, I do love them, you know, just overall in terms of design and style.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are pretty much up there for yeah. me, you know, personally.
So I guess that sort of rounds off this interview. We have mentioned it throughout, but so if listeners, where can they find you?
Okay, you know, obviously Instagram at writestuff.official, R-I-T-E, writestuff.official. You can go to my website, the-write-stuff.com. Certain stores, you know, on my website, you can see the stockists that are carrying my stuff, so you can check it out in person, which, you know, if possible, I recommend handling this stuff and looking at it in person. Mm. Because, you know, certain things, like you might see the new Slub Yarn t-shirt online and think, yeah, it's all right, you know, but when you feel and see that fabric in person, you'll definitely change, you know, might change your mind.
Yeah.
You know, so you can find me also my personal account on Instagram, Write Stuff Brian. You know, just Brian reach out to me.
Brian with a Y.
Brian with a Y. Yeah. Not with an I, but with a Y. And just reach out. You know, I try to make myself available,
mm-hmm.
you know, and respond to stuff. You know, not like a big brand that, you know, might not get back to you. I respond to a lot of stuff. Especially, you know, Instagram, DMs. I'm always, you know, DMing back and forth with people or emailing people.
All right. So I guess that brings us to the question section of this episode. And we did get a couple questions coming in while I was away, but I think we'll answer one of them now. Actually, there was two questions that was more or less identical. One came in from Robert to Disco. Sorry, Robert. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. And then Paul, Glowing Glass, he already asked a question earlier as well. But the question is, why does denim get heavier after wash? So that was in relation to something we talked about in a previous episode about when you wash your jeans, they will get heavier. And I think we probably needed to clarify that we were only really talking about unsanitized denim when we were talking about, you know, denim getting heavier when you wash it at home. So basically what happens if you know, the answer, I guess, is, you know, that when you weave denim, the yarn will stretch out a little bit, you know, throughout the entire production of it, really. So once you wash it, the yarn will basically relax again and, you know, get back to its original shape, really. And that means that's why it shrinks. So, and because there's more mass per square yard, square centimeter, square whatever, it's heavier. I guess the explanation to that. Right, Jake, you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically that it shrinks, so it's the same amount of fabric now in a smaller area. So the jeans don't actually gain weight. They gain weight per area.
Exactly.
Is basically what it is.
Exactly. Very well put. So, well, yeah, I guess that answers that question. And sorry for, the being confusing there previously, but should be clarified now. So, we did get another question, but I think we'll save that for the next episode. And at this point, I guess it's just really saying thank you to Brian for coming onto the show. It's been a real pleasure hearing your story and learning how you started your brand.
Thanks for having me. Sorry, I don't have a radio-friendly voice, but...
No, I mean, neither do I. It's only Jake that has that really sweet voice, right?
No, you guys sound, professional.
Oh, yeah.
It's been very interesting, though, to learn about this and how you got there and, like, starting a brand like this.
Yeah, really.
It's very cool, and it's, I'm obviously grateful because now I have one of my favorite color shirts. I can have it again, even though I was going to lose it. So now, basically, I got kind of a replacement for it.
Yep. And maybe another red one in the future and an ecru one, so...
Yeah, basically, like... If we can get it less pink, right? That was kind of the discussion, right?
Mm.
Yeah, it is like a straightforward cherry, you know, fire truck red fabric. This fabric comes in a few different colors. I've got it in front of me. The swatch, light gray, black, fire truck red, straight brown, very light blue.
Ooh, brown.
Mm. Yeah, dark blue, like indigo. Green, the sage green, and then like this purple blue kind of color that maybe people will like it, but it's kind of not purple, kind of not blue.
So blurple, so GameCube, like, original GameCube controller color.
Yeah, it's original GameCube sort of blurple color. if you just look at that yarn, it's definitely blurple GameCube, but when you mix it with the white, it becomes hard to tell what color it is.
Very interesting. Yeah. We're going to see that. Yeah, I mean, you could bring it out to your followers, really. But,
Yeah.
Right. So, thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll catch you in the next one.
Later.